Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Jason Hazley.
And I'm Joel Morris.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works. Or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is the award-winning giant of comedy, Dara O'Brien.
Hello!
Hello.
Welcome to the Volcano Base.
It's a pleasure to be here in what is clearly Corrupt FM, the episode 2 of that show, where you've just nailed foam to the wall.
This is a huge move forward from using Ladybird books as baffling, which we had in the old office.
Yeah. Yes, but as you can tell, it's been very much decorated by amateurs.
Yeah, it is. I mean, again, I'm not sure of the science of any of the placing of any of these random collection of eggshell squares that you've done.
It's been done aesthetically rather than acoustically.
Yes, yeah. That seems to be the wrong thing.
No, I look at it, I don't really think it's been done aesthetically.
It's ugly. Well, obviously you can't enjoy any of this at home, but yes, we are in what appears to be a gang hut, we have put some foam on the walls, but that's the joy of podcasting, isn't
it? Yes, it is.
If you went somewhere very swish, you'd wonder what we'd spent the no money on.
Yeah.
Every penny is on the walls.
I just think it's very on brand that you have made your albums acoustically sound in the same way as a sitcom did. I just think that's very, it's a nod, it's a reference.
It is.
And that is very wise in knowing.
People just do podcasts.
Yeah, you homaged your own office to a sitcom guy.
Dara, it's brilliant that you've agreed to come on, because I bumped into you in Edinburgh and you were saying you'd enjoyed how rude we were about stand-up.
Yes, we are. And actually, I think I found that quite refreshing, because I think there is, obviously, rightly, a lot of analysis of stand-up. But there's nothing stand-up like more than analysing stand-up and discussing it as the queen of sciences that it is. that's actually the term for mathematics. And there's some really good ones. I mean, Stuart Goldsmith's Comedians podcast is fantastic. Mm. And there are any number of other ones in which comedians go stroke your beard and discuss what we do is both instinctual and also reflective and elemental and really get into it way too much. So I actually quite enjoyed the fact that the direction you took on it was leaving stand-up, and what a relief that was. There's losing the sense of obligation that stand-up is the doorway into the comedy industry, and it was a very refreshing take, and I feel you've completely, any of the kudos you built up by doing that, you have lost by inviting me on now, and so that this cancer can seep into even your podcast about stand-up talking about itself.
If you do have a sort of feeling, which I probably do a little bit about stand-up, that it does annoy me that very often it's the default mode of comedy discussion, stand-ups talking to stand-ups. So we thought, we'll do something about giving up stand-up, just to say, it's a hard job and sometimes people don't like it or sometimes it doesn't suit a certain temperament. But it doesn't mean I don't like stand-up. I'm really glad we're getting a chance to talk about it today.
Well, actually, yeah, I think it is. There is a certainly tendency in Edinburgh to regard Edinburgh and the one-person solo show as being the essential path of how you get into becoming any kind of comedy performer. Like, we even knew, when I was doing it, you could see the stand-ups were the ones who were on, say, from 6 o'clock till midnight. The sketch and character people were on from 4 to 6. And we'd know, like, that generally, Ben and Arne and Orma Meaton and all these people, like, whatever. And you see them hanging around at 6 as we arrived in, sashayed in to do our late-night evening shows where they'd done their character-based shows, like whatever, and there was a real schism between those those two times. And then as it went on, their shows were difficult for them to tour. Sketches, it's very difficult to tour, it's very difficult to bring anywhere. Like, but the brass ring of those 10 greatest moments in the history of comedy always came from that lot. Always came from Williams and Catherine Tate and of that generation. Yeah. Because stand-up is ultimately quite ephemeral. Some things land in a sort of big way, but nothing lands as big as a character. So they were quietly doing their work to smaller audience, and we thought we were the kings, but little knowing that we were smushed up against the ceiling, that they would vault and fall to a bar and become beloved, and they would create moments. So the stuff that people think of when they think of comedy out there is very rarely stand-up.
It's very weird because I think the divides within comedy always are surprising to outsiders who just consume comedy and assume it's a big thing. It's the comedy has a, there's a comedy department at broadcasters and it's all doing one thing, and actually it's divided into tiny little slices. We used to joke sometimes, we bump into people like Jed Parsons, who writes for Have I Got News For You, and we say, I'm sorry, your department is a wry look at the week's news. We're mainly a sideways look at modern life. And I'm sorry, we never meet otherwise. We meet at a BBC party once a year, but otherwise we really don't work on the same shows. You can divide your skill up into tiny, tiny slices.
Yes, you can. You can niche it as much as you want.
But you know the strokey beardy thing?
Yeah.
I know what you mean about that, but what's the problem with that? Is the problem that it's you're doing it out loud? Because presumably you, as a stand-up, have to subject all your material to quite a degree of scrutiny and trial, don't you?
Yeah, well, you do, but you actually, a lot of it is kind of a retrospective analysis. I have a question that I'm asked repeatedly about science and the relationship between science. Oh, you do science and you do comedy. Surely there's no relation with that. And I have a stock answer to the stock question about how a lot of what you do in maths, for example, is using logical tricks like reducto ad absurdum, where you take, where you presume something incorrect and then you follow it to a conclusion, and if it leads to an inconsistency like 2 equals 1, then therefore you throw the initial assumption is wrong, right? And we sort of instinctively do that all the time. When you talk to an audience member and they make a mistake and you go, really? And you leap, and then you create a universe in which this is a central part of their life. And then until eventually it just breaks under the contradictions and it's all very funny. But and so there are certain things that you will do in stand-up which are an argument. This, therefore this, therefore this, therefore this, therefore this, and the audience will follow quite naturally. But I think that only works retrospectively. You can't write the thing. I mean, you don't go, oh, I think it's time for a rule of three now. I don't think you can do that. What it goes under, of course, is that it goes under that shaping by evolution process of doing it over and over and over again.
It's experiment.
Which may be the one thing within scripted comedy and stand-up comedy, which is the one huge difference, that our stuff, we perform it, and it I'm 115 dates into a tour as we're doing this.
Wow.
So it's constantly changing and adding, and little slight little moments being put into it. Only in the last week, there's a joke in the current show about VR, where somebody takes off the VR mask and a scene is unfolding in front of them. I used to go straight from that to the other people in the room.
Yeah.
But now it is, you take off the mask and you do their face realizing it before you tell people what it is. That's another laugh. And
I've only
just noticed that. There's times I've pushed an audience away in order to get them to gel, which is you've gone onto a quiet night.
Yeah.
And then I've decided to abuse the audience and tell them what a terrible audience they are, as an effort to at least pull them together in going, oh, I'm unhappy with the fact that he doesn't like us. At least get one unified emotion into the room.
Wow.
And then take from there and I can get them back in again.
Really?
Yeah.
And that works.
It works because it's just breaking the tension. Sometimes there is no tension there. An audience is a thing, is a living entity in itself. It is an organism. Right?
Yeah.
And you very quickly, when you want to become a stand-up, I found this in college, I started doing debate in college and telling jokes in front of crowds, like whatever. And over the course of that, my view of a group, a collection of people change from it just being a collection of people who are sitting quietly waiting for their lecture to start to I walk past lecture theatres and go, oh, I could get a rush off them. I could, that's a crowd there. I could go in and so you begin to think of them as one organism, right? But sometimes you walk out and they just haven't been that. They haven't become that. And you're your own warm up, like whatever. And so sometimes the laugh you get from an audience is always a breaking of tension anyway. Sometimes the tension to break is you berating them. I did the Just for Laughs in Montreal once, and Joan Rivers was emceeing it. And Joan Rivers came out, she just a few jokes, all going fine. And then she had this weird kind of thing, she had a dress over her dress with this kind of like white splodgy pattern on it, because she's doing a Monica Lewinsky joke. She said, and look, I borrowed this dress off my friend Monica Lewinsky, whatever. And it didn't get anything. And I'm at the wings watching this going, oh, that didn't really go well. And Joan Rivers launched into a rant at the audience going, how dare you not laugh? This I ruined a perfectly good Donna Karan. And I don't mean DKNY for you people in the Chiefs. Donna Karan dress for the purpose of that. And you have the cheek to come in here and not laugh. And she punches them up into the sky, boom, bam, 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 pams them up like whatever, and then drops them. And there wasn't even specific words in it, but she just bang, 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 and she let them go, and a massive round of applause.
Wow,
that's and it was incredible. Just pure energy. That's all it was. She just went, I'll put tension, 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 tension. But it's funny, but it was like still tension, 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 and then wah, and she dropped them, and in the bit where they fall from where she's punched them up in the sky, and splash. Like milk on the they all went, oh, that release, huge round of applause, and then from there on in she's crying.
What you're watching there is you're watching them watch someone do their scales. This is what I can play on this instrument, and at the end of it, there's no way you're not going to feel I'm in safe hands here, I suppose.
Yeah. It felt like, listen, I've been doing this for 40 years, so yeah, this is how this works, and I'm not, you've not been doing this for 40 years. I've been doing it for, you really have to up your game. This is a phrase you often say to the audience. When you actually, I generally say, you're going to have to get better this, lads. I have not come here now to work with this, like whatever. And it honestly draws an audience together, like whatever. You learn, the most important thing you learn, weirdly, is not to put up with a gig not doing well. Not to just plow through.
Oh, right.
And I remember the Dying and Late in Life doing that midnight gig. A gig that went so badly that, God rest his soul, Hovis Presley. Hovis came up to me after and says, do you do this for a living? And I actually stopped it. I remember going 10 minutes, and I'd gone, and I was plowing through it. And then I remember stopping and going, look, I'm causing you more pain than you're causing me at this stage. Why do we say we just knock this on the head, like whatever? And I left with some dignity, but it was the problem was I kept going. I think when you're starting off, you think, oh God, that joke didn't work. Let's try the next joke. And then let's try the next joke, and your mouth gets dry, and you start speeding up, and you start end gaming all the jokes by rushing straight to the bit, which is the funny bit, because you're sure that's the bit that'll slowly spark it. And actually, no, you have to stop. And go.
And what it shows is that you're not reading the room, doesn't it? If you don't respond to the audience not having a good time, if you don't get down into the weeds with them and go, what have I done wrong then? Come on, guys,
There was a night in the Comedy Store where we went all out. Now, I remember Stuart Francis was on and a few others, and it was just your standard Saturday night, early show, 8 o'clock in the Comedy Store. We all went out and did our stuff. Great night. Comedy Store is a fabulous room. Hey, there's a group of 5 backpackers in the front row who were just beaming because this is their cultural thing. They come and this is amazing. It's exactly what they wanted. Cheering, whatever. And we're all delighted, whatever. And then we went out for the 11 o'clock show, 5 backpackers. I loved the first show so much, they came back in to watch the second show. In that thing that people have that's like, oh, they just talk. These people just come out and stage and they just talk.
And
everything is funny. And it was actually, I think the MC or the first act, so they've gone through 10 minutes of the same stuff. And then he goes, hang on, are you the people who were here earlier, right? And then the MC came in to us and said, they're all just sitting in the front row. The same 5 people with that kind of slightly more strained. The first person to go out didn't have time. He just walked down and said, oh, and bam, and straight into his 20-minute club set and they're slightly slumping. And the rest of us then had to go, oh, what have we got? What have we got? another 20 minutes, whatever. And some did and some didn't.
Because I tell you what, coming to see your show recently, the thing that I started to think about is that those hours are actually very carefully structured. There's lots of stuff in there which is set up, paid off, called back, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
There is a shape to it. It's not just a series of smaller routines. And if you're having to reassemble a show or put together like the Moscow one that you're talking about, you're then having to take chunks of existing shows and try and bolt them together, or are you just sort of doing them in a line?
I'd say the earliest was more episodic and more kind of and less nested than the current show. Certainly in the last couple of shows, I've gone bigger for a structure that pays off and things loop around and come back in again. I speak of it like it's an incredibly complex narrative. Sorry, callbacks.
It's a Klein bottle of comedy.
That's exactly what I'm looking for. It exists in four dimension, but also in three space. And so that is that. The next time I get that from the general kind of interviewer going, any science and comedy, I will do the think of a non-Riemannian manifold that exists in an n-dimensional plane, but its curvature is negative. And that's my show. You know, obviously that's my show. Like a wormhole that goes from that joke to that joke. It is more difficult now, and you actually actively have to think about it. Sometimes quite liberating when you do the Apollo, for example, and just snip out the bits. Quite nice.
Oh, what we're talking about here, which I think is something that fascinates us, which is why this podcast exists, is the invisible craft of comedy. You're watching when you're watching comedy. Hopefully, is you're not watching three act structure or you're not watching callbacks and things. You're watching someone talking or characters existing, and you are just enjoying their motion and their movement. But it should look effortless. It should be exactly what those backpackers were expecting. It's just those guys chatting. It's a funny guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think the stand-up set you've brought in and the comedian that you've nominated to talk about today is a perfect example of someone who appears to be making up on the fly, whose opening, his Joan Rivers opening, is not a zinger. Very often it's standing on stage and going, as if he's just been found there. It looks so effortless. And the more you look at it, the more you realise it's not. Who have you brought in?
Well, listen, let me give one brief context to this, which is that years ago I did a documentary about Stephen Hawking, and we based around the fact that I still had a copy of Brief History of Time that I was given as a Christmas present of 16 that I, through various house moves, still had, and I was able to bring this artifact out, right?
Yeah.
When we'd already arranged to do this, it was in the office, and I looked up in the shelf and realised that on the shelf of my office there was still this, the actual VHS copy that I was given with the furry kind of frontage and all that of this. So this is clearly sufficiently important to me that this went to house moves as well.
Wow.
For the last 20 years. It's from 1996. It is Eddie Izzard and Definite Article.
It's called, they call it coming out of a book, and you've got to do it at some point in your life, haven't you? You've got to just fucking come out of a book, you know, surprise your neighbours. Whey, the fucking big book next door, yes. Andy Warhol said it, you've always got to come out of a book at some point, he said, and then he had a big hair.
It's the third big one.
Live at the Ambassadors.
He's buried that, as far as I know. He's held onto the copyright of it. I don't think he's particularly.
Really?
I think that one is very, very difficult to get, which means that the one that most people have seen first is unrepeatable.
Yeah. I think I've got it on VHS.
Oh, do you? Okay.
Because
I think he looks
very different. He's got nail polish on, but otherwise he's just in a schlubby suit. But that first one, it's a different guy.
Yeah.
Definite Article is kind of him becoming Eddie Izzard.
Yeah, well, definitely, because there was the first thing I ever saw him do was Le Songe d'un Larbe.
I saw him do that on Hysteria.
Montreal, whatever. And I found a crackly version of it YouTube last night.
And the first line I was ever taught in that was Le Singe est dans l'arbre. The monkey is in the tree. And it's just really difficult to get that one into a conversation. You're going there, go, une chambre, oui, merci, okay. Oui, en vacances, okay. Une chambre, avec une douche, with a shower, mais le singe est dans l'arbre.
And it is actually it's not fully formed. It's
really
it's on the
way,
because he redid the routine again, I think, in Circle or one of those couple of after this, where he redid it, partly because he and this is so Eddie Izzard, Le Songe d'un Larbe is incorrect. It's a very clumsy translation. So he changed it to Le Songe a sur la branche, because you're not in the tree. You're on the tree rather than. So if you were laughing along, but going, that's a really bad translation of it, like whatever. So actually the phrase was wrong. So Eddie changed, but then he expanded it all out in a huge way. Yeah. But I remember dying laughing at Le Songe d'un Larbe.
We watched that on a caravan holiday. The reason we went to Ambassadors is because of Le Singe et dans l'Arbre. I remember I went, should we go and see Le Singe et dans l'Arbre guy?
Yeah.
And that was enough to get us to go buy tickets for an expensive West End show.
Yeah.
I mean, it is kind of strange that that doesn't happen more often to a certain extent. There should be more routines that are, I mean, we talk about he's got the routine on this or such and such, a routine on that, like whatever. And there's certain routines that if you look back, I look back over myself going, okay, the video game routine is probably one that came out. There's a couple of sciencey ones that could quote a lot in particular. Things like whatever there are certain things that, but like it's very difficult to get a single out, and he got a couple of singles out like whatever. Darth Vader in the canteen things that they don't break through as often, hence we're saying the character stuff Delroy falling through the bar, but Le Singe dans l'Arbre, which is just nice to say. This is pleasing.
Especially nice to say in his voice.
Yeah, well,
if you have to be on your heels and deliver it like that, it's a pleasure.
There was a period where I had to beat the Eddie Izzard out of myself. Because when I started off, I had a much softer voice, and I go a lot anyway, so I have a touch of that kind of like hanging noise thing, but not as pronounced as he does it, or in the way that he uses it. But I slipped into that idiom. When you're a baby stand-up, you often pluck the stuff you love, like whatever. Yeah. I remember Ed Burns' sister Trish going, yeah, you went very, very Eddie for a while. Because I thought this was before I'd even done stand-up, but this is 1996. I'd already started doing gigs when I sat and watched this. So it was exactly at a formative moment for me to suddenly go,
it's a compelling sound.
It is. It works. I suppose the nearest equivalent I have is that Jewish New York, Jackie Mason, Zoidberg, kind of, what, I'm telling you, that thing, which is just very Moorish and very difficult to do, what, is very difficult not to, because it's just perfect rhythm for comedy. And his...
To eat a satsuma, it's a piece of piss. So you just go flump, and then flump, and flump. And if there's people in the room, you go on. It's like a very cheap round, isn't it? Go on. Satsuma. And if you're that other person in the room, you go, no, all right, So Satsuma is great.
And you're right. He walks out at the start of this. It's a big dramatic. A big door opens. It's ludicrously staged.
A huge book. Standard.
A huge book. And he walks down some steps.
He's on a throne coming out of
a
book.
Yes, he comes out of it on a throne, like whatever. And like, so you kind of have to go, right, you're quite new, but like you're already doing 10 weeks in this is in the Shaftesbury, like whatever, which is the equivalent of doing 10 Wembleys like this stage. So he was big at this stage. But then he comes down and the first thing he says was like, right? And resets the applause, I feel.
Yeah. Yes.
Into, and I think one of the things that he does is My Universe.
Yes.
It's obvious what he does with it, but he does you've got to come here. Famously, he was a street performer for many years, but you can see that he just recalibrates the audience right at the very start.
Come down, lean it. I'm going to lean back, you're going to have to lean in.
Yes, and you're going to have to lean in. We always define an audience in terms of how much you have to go to them and how much they come to you.
Right.
And the leaning back is, you have to come to me. The paradox of, if it's a really raucous audience, do you go louder or do you go quieter?
Right.
And there's always a sign of complete confidence if you go quiet and the audience then have to shush to hear you. It's not a given that that will always work. There's a gig at the end of the last festival in Kilkenny. It's a weekend festival, and there's a gig on the Monday night. So the punters have all left, and this is a gig basically for the people of Kilkenny who've been working in bars and nightclubs and restaurants and servicing this entire thing. Hmm. And they put on one shrine show at the end where we all do like 5 minutes. I remember it was really rocks. 600 people in a bar, 1 a.m. And so we're all trying to shout and anger. I'm going to do my best of, bang, 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 bang. Tommy Tiernan goes out and just stood at the mic and then started singing Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen. And quietly, they say, and the whole room went quiet. After 2 hours of shouting, the whole room went quiet, and they all quietly sang 3 verses of Hallelujah with Tommy. And then when they were quiet, Tommy started his routine.
Wow.
And
it
just ends, you go, I give up. This is ridiculous.
I'm lost. That is too.
That's a game we can't even see. That is that's the four-dimensional chess.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a shop in South London, and it sells two very disparate items. One side is guns and knives and harpoons. On the other side, there's banjos and violins and bassoons. Someone browsing around, a noisy machine gun, slice a man in two, 200 rounds a minute, or a banjo. Bang, bang, bang.
This is a Western audience who've come to see him, but yeah. Nonetheless, a step back. Whatever. And he's like, his first word, I forgot what's the first word, but it's something ridiculous like, aardvark.
I was comparing this to, when I first saw him, I thought what was amazing is he used this very gentle, very relaxed, addictively relaxed energy to do stuff that was actually very similar in content to a good, sharp American stand-up. It was about religion, mainland bombing campaigns. It was quite political about sort of not believing in what you were told. It was kind of Bill Hicksy, sort of, right. I've seen the world, this is how it works. It isn't religion mad. Here's some stuff about Catholicism and church schools. And here he is two or three years later doing the same technique, but his opening word is thimbles.
Thimbles! It's thimbles!
And it's to go, you're going to do a routine about thimbles, and it's the most confident thing is he's not going to come out and say, I've had a big thought about the world. He went, let's talk about thimbles for a bit.
So we're here, this is the video, very, very special video of all the incredibly funny things in my brain, I suppose. Yeah. But thimbles is what I really wanted to talk about, because...
And he's realised that the tone of voice is so addictive that it doesn't matter what he's talking about, he can still take a load of shit and turn it to gold. Yeah. I will start with the most unpromising, smallest thing. But weirdly, the word thimbles is not only funny, but it says small, quiet.
Yeah.
It's so confident. And I wonder whether there was something in this, in the development of a stand-up voice that has become very influential, in that a lot of stand-ups who now do huge rooms don't do personal or political stuff. They do Peter Kay's, has anyone been to a wedding?
Yeah.
There's a bit of Michael McIntyre and a bit of Peter Kay in this, and saying, I've got such a good delivery, I can put almost nothing in. It isn't breathing. It's kind of at that level of a whole room will come together and agree. You might lose half the room on a Donald Trump routine, but thimbles, no one can disagree with. It's like a Michael McIntyre's We've All Got a Draw kind of routine where you go, this can unite a huge room in a way that some stand-up, maybe from earlier, would have said, which tiny tribe are you from? Are you from the north or whatever? It's so non-tribal.
But did
it
you not
feels
have
really
the,
exciting.
Did you not have the reaction that I did to that, which is when he comes out and he just does a tiny preamble and says, but what I really want to talk about is thimbles. My brain went, I had to just process it for a beat and go, fuck, I'm going to have to run to keep up with you, aren't I? I really am.
I don't know, it's a bit frightening.
It does, I mean, there is a thing that the Trust Me, I'm a Comic jokes, which you often start a show with, especially right. in Edinburgh. You come out and you go, here's four quick laughs, thus that you can all relax now.
That's, I can do this.
Yeah, I can do this, okay? You often put them at the start, like whatever. You pray in the process by which you write a show, which is basically you throw stuff at a wall and then you rearrange it into a shape. You hope that you have an applause at the end of the first half, applause at the end of the second half, bigger one for the encore, and then maybe some at the start. And then you've got some framework there that you can come out with a thing. Right, okay. But you come out and then really the first things aren't, I'm right in the middle of this. We're in the middle of this now. That's nicely unmooring because you're going oh wow and like because it's not the one thing about it we talk about structured shows and like I would write a thing that has very much progression and it goes from thing to thing to thing and I work on the joins between things so it feels like it flows from place to place. There he does new joins. Does that and it's I suppose probably what people always compare it with Monty Python or whatever. It just stops the thing and goes the next thing.
Yeah. John Cleese said he was, in a way, sort of an extra Python, the missing Python. And I thought, well, a lot of the techniques aren't really Pythonic, but the disjointedness, the feeling that he is starting down an alleyway, and then if he gets bored with it, very often two or three words in, that he'll stop. There is that feeling of, we don't know whether this is a profitable avenue or not, which is kind of weird to watch with someone who's got a prepared show.
Yeah.
That I think he's got some of those dead ends written in.
So it's an hour and 48 minutes long, which is at the upper end of how long these things ever got.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of it in which you went, oh, you'd probably take that out. And you're going, yeah, you actually would take that out.
Right.
You probably would just snip here and there. And certainly for a while, it seems to jump around a bit before settling into a thing that he really likes.
Yeah.
But it does draw you. And his whole thing was this unit, because it is observational, but it's it puts surreal observation. Like, and also there's a cast of characters, which is the other thing that he sets up.
Mrs. Bad Crumble.
Bad Crumble appears, I think, it's for the first time in this one.
Mrs. Bad Crumble.
James Mason. Makes his appearance or whatever, and various things, who then he brings back in again in a way that feels richer than just a callback.
Yeah.
It does feel like there is a universe where elephants are skiing over a chalet, but Mrs. Balcombe is teaching the clarinet from a previous routine in that chalet.
Yeah.
And the guy with the gun keeps going back to his clarinet lessons as he hears elephants skiing over his roof. It is, again, it's because I've seen him return to those characters again in other ones. I mean, Mrs. Balcombe appears in other DVDs. James Mason certainly appears. Darth Vader in the canteen. He returned to that a few times. I actually saw the Darth Vader in the canteen routine, not on this show, so obviously it's in a much later show. Saw it in the RDS in Dublin. Went to see the show and it was a bit that killed me, absolutely killed me. And that nice feeling that you get just where you just lose it, where you just fit. Yeah. It's a lovely thing there, where it becomes just instinctive. It's not about an idea and how smart that idea is, but it's a very defined thing which is just musical. In the sense that it's just intuitively, I'm just rolling with this.
But
there must have been a Death Star canteen, yeah? There must have been a cafeteria downstairs in between battles where Darth Vader could just chill and go down. I will have the penne alla arrabbiata. You'll need a tray. I can kill you with a single thought. But you'll still need a tray.
I remember seeing that, and there was a line in that then that I saw him do the routine again in Melbourne. So this must be in 2000 I saw him, and then 2001 I met him in Melbourne. It was the first time I'd ever met him, and I was properly like, I'm also a stand-up, and like really awful thing. And I said to him, there was a line in it that you dropped. And it was about Darth Vader has a grill on the front of his, and they take. And he says, "No, that's an egg slicer." She takes the grill off and slices an egg with it. And he had a line in which you go, in which Vader goes, "But the man in the garage said," and I just loved that line. Just every person who's not technically comfortable being taken for a ride by somebody. But the man in the garage said, like, and I said, "You didn't have any." He said, "Yeah, it kind of wasn't working." So he dumped it like whatever, and it was like my absolute fate. It was the one that killed me. Like, oh no, I love that bit.
What effect this is while you're starting in stand-up.
Did this change what you thought was possible? Absolutely, yeah, hugely, because it was so innately funny. It kind of raised the bar for lots of things, like whatever. And we were saying the Irish stand-up circuit was great fun to come to as a generation, and there was it was a tremendously, you know, it was me and Tommy and Colin Murphy and Jason Byrne and somebody just all doing our first gigs at the same time. Yeah. Literally, there was a night in the Comedy Store where it was me and Jason Byrne's first ever gigs in the Comedy Cellar in Dublin.
Wow.
And a visiting comic Andrew Maxwell was there because he was back from London where he was doing some television. We were like, oh my God, that's Andrew Maxwell. But we were all kind of coming on, and then this appeared, this glorious it was like, oh, this is, you can be loosey, you can be conversation, you can be fluid, you can, they'll come with you, you can throw two ideas together, and you can pause an M and A on stage, and the noises are the funny thing, and it's the thing that I've always felt like, whatever, the jokes are just bullets. You're the gun. You're the funny thing. But the jokes are just a tool by which you show you're funny.
Yeah.
But you're the funny thing. And so that's a huge part of what you're going, he's just funny. And like it's people say, they go, oh, he could do anything. And obviously he's not just doing anything, but he is funny, like whatever. So what he's doing is slightly less important than just their presence on stage.
He's occupying something in this, which I'm going to ask you, because I don't know how he's doing this. I don't know quite what he's doing. You may have a better idea. But there's something in, again, if you compare him to early videos, and I was remembering that Ambassador show where he's just in a suit. He's got nail varnish on, but he's not making a silhouette.
Yeah.
He's not occupying a shape. But you watch Definite Article and you've shone a light on him and he projected himself on the wall. You'd know that was Eddie Izzard.
Yeah.
The pose, the crouch. He's in this constant bouncing crouch. The heels are helping.
Oh, there's a lot of movement. There's a ton of movement.
He doesn't stop moving.
Yeah.
He's constantly in motion. And they're funny. There's a bubbling kind of up and down movement that suits the words. It's every bit of him is dedicated to getting these words to you and telling you who he is.
Yes, absolutely. And there is it's a hideous American term, the act out, where you give the idea in stand-up. You say, hey, it's a bit like this, and then you act it out.
Yeah.
And you get a second laugh on the act.
Yeah.
And it kind of feels cynical when you say it like that. It feels a course-taught way of doing it rather than an instinctive thing. The routine about there's a line of murderers.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
You're at the all-night garage and behind you the queue's all murderers.
Queue's all murderers. And he just does, and each of them is different in a similar but different way, and he does 15 of them.
3 a.m. in the morning and you're getting this and there's a queue forming behind you. No, it's brown bread. Brown bread, man, yeah. A queue of murderers. With different weapons, you know.
They're gurning, they're making faces, like whatever, and it goes on all the way across the stage. I saw him do a thing on the Live at the Apollo recently. He's skittering around the stage and he's on the back foot, and then he does a dressage pony where really they're training them to do burglary, and there was just a point where the dressage pony breaks into the house and it's just one leg lifting over a wall, then the other leg lifting over a wall, and that got a round of applause because it was so beautifully done. And it is a concept that you want movement in the show, but it's stand-up is often you're behind a mic and you could do the, like when you preview a stand-up tour, you often do it with just leave, you don't do the full kind of face mic type thing or whatever.
Yeah.
So you're behind an SM58 on a stand, like with your standard microphone on the stand, like whatever, and you're holding the stand. It's kind of fun to be back in the clubs where you're just standing behind a mic shouting these ideas at people. But then you got to go back into showbiz and do the bigger show, and you've got to put the movement into it. And there's a parent in my school of a kid in my son's class who teaches movement to opera singers.
Right.
Because she goes, they come into the shows and they sing, but they've had no reason to learn how to move because their entire career has been standing still next to a piano, belting out a Rigoletto or something like that. And it'd be weird if they started circling the piano. Like just in the middle of it all, doing a robot in the middle of La Traviata, like whatever. So they've never done that. And she said, well, you have to teach them how to just enjoy the physicality of it. And she's going, it's very weird to watch you because clearly this is the thing that you've deliberately evolved, how you move on stage. And you do, as a stand-up, develop a way of moving just to expand it out. And the two things I'll say, it's like I watched U2 play Wembley a couple of years ago, and the angle at which they
stood. I thought you meant us two.
Yeah.
No.
I was trying to remember when we'd done that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was quite drunk.
Good, but I was on the road at the time, so I missed those gigs. But they're still spoken of in legend. I watch Irish rock combo U2 play Wembley.
And let me clear that up.
In the midst of, which is a very enjoyable gig, particularly if you're Irish, I was watching them and the way they stood. Yeah. And the angle at which they stood was the correct angle for standing in the stadium. Because I find as you play bigger rooms, you just tilt, you naturally tilt back.
You end up in the Conservative Party conference power stance.
It's a form of that, but they again endgame that. They told them to go straight to that. They haven't earned it by doing the journey to it. So, but it is a thing that you know to expand your arms out. And you just do that by doing it hundreds of times. And you realize, oh, this works better if I just expand a bit in the way I stand, like whatever. And watching them who's playing, they must have been in a million stadiums over the course of their career. It's the way they stood was just tilted exactly at the midpoint, the gravity point of that whole huge room.
Visually representing what the art is that you're giving out. So Eddie Izzard's bobbing, sort of naughty, puckish crouch suits who he is.
He's jumping from subject to subject and moving around.
Bobbing around.
And whereas you hold the microphone stand with the mic in it and you slyly look over it, that is much more of a combative club kind of stance where you're going, and you're pointing down at people from behind this elevated
position. Anyone ever done the Lemmy stroke Liam Gallagher stand-up where you're staring at the sky with a microphone above? That would be awful.
I would love to see. Where you're just shouting that. Yeah, that'd be me. I'm not sure if that would connect. I'm not sure if that
would. Very good for the people in the circle.
Yeah.
Yeah, so fuck Pears, but Pears are really, just, you know, like a rock. So you think, I'll take them home and they'll ripen up. But you put them in a bowl at home and they sit there going, no, don't ripen yet. Wait till he goes out of the room. Ripen now. You come back in, you go, I'll just have one of that. Hey, these pears are dead.
So what's he doing then? Because the first thing you arrive at as a conclusion with this is you go, it's whimsy.
Yeah.
And then I thought, it's actually observation, but via the back door. He kind of does, I was looking at the very front of the show where he does that routine about horses' hooves.
Yeah.
And I thought, in the hands of someone who didn't have Eddie Izzard's mind, you could reduce that to a really simple one-liner.
Yeah.
They don't need shoes. They've got great, big, thick, bony, you know, you could do that.
Yeah.
Very simple, and you probably get a laugh from that. But he does it back to front. And with so many lovely little variations, like the bit about, because horseshoes are lucky, they're wearing four bits of lucky, you know, and things like that. And you go, you've taken a straight observation and then just spun it round and round.
There's a gag he does about oranges. We did the same observation in a news parody programme recently, which is oranges are really annoying. They're the most annoying fruit. No one really likes oranges. And he does the thing. But his one, he goes, there's Jürgen Prochnow inside the orange saying, none shall get in. It's like a submarine. You mustn't breach the hull. And you're thinking, he's really good at when he sort of says something like, aren't oranges fiddly, to go, right, okay, what I'll do is I'll be the orange, or who's inside the orange?
It does an impression of a pear rotting, doesn't it, at one point?
Fantastic. And it's a great, you know, I've even seen him do, sometimes the shower is hot and sometimes the shower is cold because there's a tiny thing that goes from hot to cold. But he's done it in a way which is, again, he does very, very well, physically extremely well, or whatever. And it's like I say, you're right. This could be a 20-minute set. what's up with the sound of Latin, like whatever, but instead it's like a domo, it's a winner, and it's drawn out and then it's reincorporated in and they're all pokey sticks and twang them into a tree. So now I'm just doing moments from the thing, like whatever. But you're right, they are observations, they're accurate observations. Probably the parallel now I draw would be Acaster, is probably one that you could say. James Acaster is like, it is observational, but it's coming from a totally different direction to where Michael is doing. And I'm not going to rag on Michael. Michael's very good at what he does. Michael McIntyre is extremely good at what he does, like whatever, and finding that thing. I think he's
borrowed a lot from this. The bobbing energy.
I
was surprised how much I saw, this is how you play a big room. And I think that this has gone into a lot of stand-ups as how you play and unify a big room with come into my world, and your world, you then work out which degree of absurdity you've got in your world.
Yeah.
It may be solidly observational, or it may be whimsical, but you're using the same techniques.
Yeah, it does. It feels like it's very much a jumping point. And when you are in your heads and the writing things, you do find yourself scribbling down just things like the and just like I put down. I remember scribbling down a note of biting the inside of my own mouth.
Yeah,
and it sat in a file somewhere for ages, and then became the third point in reasons we have not been created in the image of God, and it was reason two: we bite the insides of our own. Who? Why? Why would God create? Yeah, and it was banked somewhere. Banked as a yeah. Oh, could that be used? That's an interesting thing. But you stuck it in a pile again. Second time I met Eddie, I could map out my life in times I've met Eddie. Second thing was at Best of the Fest in Edinburgh, and I had a joke about fox hunting. And how ridiculous fox hunting was, because they quite get dressed up for it. Like, if it's a fox hunting, why people in towns don't put on a tuxedo to lay down a mousetrap or whatever, and it's some sort of thing, like whatever. And it was slightly better than that, I'd like to say. But it was like, it's a line, like whatever. And there you go. And I said, you could do much more with that, like whatever. And I said, I had this kind of depressing sense that if he had done it, he'd have had the whole thing, you know. He'd have, yeah. And they're, you know, yeah. And they're in the town, like whatever, and they're chasing, yeah, you know.
Is that what you're watching here? It's now occurring to me that the joy of this is that I kept looking at thinking that observation's pretty basic.
Yeah.
As in, you'll start off with something, which again, well, a basic observation, there's nothing wrong with a basic observation because it unites a room. If you sort of say, oh, the queue that you're not in at the supermarket always goes faster, that's a pretty basic.
Yeah.
I've heard that a million times from people. They even use it in The Young Ones as a throwaway gag.
We're all very good at queue strategy now, have you noticed? No one taught us this. We just go, we're going, okay, four looks pretty good. Seven. No, quite a few people, all hand baskets, they're good. It'll move fast. 17's just opened up. You take the French bread. You go on 17. I'm on 4. Keep in touch.
I've heard that thing, but what he'll do is the routines that have got into this show are the ones where he started with an observation that everyone goes, ah, and then before you notice he's ridden off onto the sunset on it, he's taken you for a 5-minute riff on that. And it seems to me that they're quick observations that the ones he can spin more out of make it into this set. The joy is not sometimes the original idea, but it's where he goes with it.
Absolutely. I think that's a very important thing you can do in stand-up, which is very much more difficult to do in other types of comedy, particularly for the style of comedy where you're writing for a show, like a topical news show, for example. Let's pick a random example, where producers will give you a list of these are the topics on which we would like your jokes. At that point, do your, and for some drivers, like Jade Goody was always, when I was coming through anything, whatever, that it was that kind of like character. And if you could do your joke about that, or you could do your joke about Brexit now, or you could do your joke about David Davis there. Like, you're going, I this isn't a, you know, this is the dullest form, it's a sausage machine kind of thing that I'm throwing out, like whatever.
We suggested once there should be a website or an app for working writers where you type in drunk and it tells you who's this week's drunk. And it used to be George Best, and for a while it was Pete Doherty. And maybe you've not been following the news and it's turned out that someone else has got an alcohol. Who's the fat person this week?
Yeah.
And it would just tell you who's gone bankrupt. And it would keep you constantly up to date with who people are going to get when you say, money, is it Gary Barlow or is it Ken Dodd this week?
Yeah.
And it's when you're working in that field, you sometimes feel so formulaic. Whereas actually the joy of what you do with a joke very often isn't the jumping off point, it's where you take it.
We did there used to be a monologue at the start of Mock the Week. And then I'd push for it to go because it was that. It was like
that's your meat and potatoes.
Sherry Blair is unattractive and such is this and such and such is that. And
Mark Thatcher gets lost. Yes. Remember those ones?
Oh, and it was the same stuff coming up and up and up again, like whatever. And it was just really.
It's dangerous at the moment because back in the day you could probably get away with it. Now Twitter will have done those jokes first.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Whereas when you're writing a show, what isn't important is the initial, isn't the jumping off point. It's if that's the one. And if you give me 40 topics, it's random when I'll go, oh, this is, I see a thing there. I see something you can do more with there. And I could do an act out of a thing there and that could turn into something else, like whatever. And so if you look back at your own shows, the routines that became long and current didn't necessarily start from anything that was necessary to do. You know, entire routine of the film 2012 that involved telling people about the film 2012.
No plot. Just John Cusack running away from lava for 2.5 hours. And always just slightly ahead of the lava. Oh God, lava! Oh Jesus, lava! Quick, get into the car! He drove off, the lava sped up. Then he gets into a plane, the lava accelerates again. After about 1.5 hours of this brinksmanship, you're going, Jesus, John, I'm spotting a pattern here, right? Why don't you hold still for a minute and see what the lava does then? Will it come up to you and go, Oh, Jesus, he's called our bluff. Quick, get back down the hall. We got nothing. He's called.
But then ends with me in giant sleeves and maracas on stage on the night with Jimmy Mystery from Strictly Come Down. The two of us both, him recreating a scene he did in 2012. And we all strip off our clothes and we're dancing in maracas. Like whatever. I saw not very good film recently. And it could be, oh, that's a bit mad. But it's not. It's just, you don't know the ones that are going to pique your interest, that are going to fire a neuron, and that's going to be the thing that's going to go, like whatever. And we have the luxury of doing it because we've got a 6 month writing period. We put together a show where you're throwing stuff and you're literally going, that's a thing. And someday your brain will put two and two together and that'll become 10 minutes for a really good stand up tour. Six good ideas.
Really?
Six good ideas is a classic show. three or four good ideas is a pretty solid show.
Wow.
And that's 2 hours. Because there'll be other stuff around it, like whatever. But they will be the signature bits of it. My favourite of all the ones I've ever done really had six clear ideas.
But that's incredible. Eddie Izzard, I suppose, is a pioneer in saying, because the joy of what you're watching is the process of turning this base metal into gold.
Yes.
That you watch it, and he's an enormously hopeful figure to look at, and a very, very high bar to hit, because that magic is in his throat and in his brain.
Yeah, there is an element to which that when you write a stand-up show, you write a one-person sitcom in which you are the person in the comedy show, where you hopefully have your character already. Was it on this show? Somebody said the way if a stand-up has become what they are is if you should know how they react when they fall in a swimming pool. Have you heard that?
No.
Yeah. That all stand-up, if stand-up is actually any good, if their stage persona is any good, you should know exactly how they'll react if they fell in a swimming pool.
That's superb.
And I don't know if the test generally for that somebody came up for comedy characters, like whatever, that you should know what their stance is, either the panic person or whatever. Yeah. But that you should know who you are. And then you should put you in different situations and you should react to those different situations. Now, obviously, he's not doing him as much, but he's doing his spin on things. But it is, I know who I am. And this is how I think about these things. Well, it's an interesting calibration between whimsy and surreality.
Yes.
Yeah, and he stays on the whimsy side of it, all right, or whatever. I find myself watching surreal things going, how do you know that that's right? How do you know that's the right one to do, like whatever? Yeah, he definitely stays on the whimsy side of it, because it would be jarring if suddenly there's a fish on a bicycle.
Because he acts out and he takes the idea for a walk, by the end of the whimsy, it's not just a juxtaposition. It's not just sticking a hat on a buffalo.
Yeah.
He's shown you the buffalo buying a hat. And you go, oh, yeah.
Yes, but the buffalo's behaving in a Bexhill-on-Sea manner.
Yeah.
The buffalo talking in a normal...
It's a Bexhill buffalo.
Yeah,
Bexhill
buffalo, yes. It's a buffalo that exists in this universe that he lives, where buffaloes interact with the hat sets in a perfectly reasonable way.
He's holding a solid world together, which
While we're on buffaloes, or buffalee, I'm not sure what the plural would be, do we all remember Cows, his sitcom?
Yeah, I never saw it. I remember the whole thing about Cows being where they're finally giving him a chance to make the thing.
Yes.
What a glorious era that was, where that could happen.
Would that would happen? Who would do that now?
I was about to say, what a terrible idea. I went, oh God, wouldn't it be lovely if accidentally people made things like Cows? Because one of those Cows might work, pilots.
It's though it didn't work, it is very Izzard, isn't it? I mean, we're talking about the show where we've got the mouse version of the Italian job.
Yeah.
You know, so you sort of go, well, yeah, of course, a sitcom full of people dressed as cows. Yeah, absolutely, yes, of course that would happen. Why wouldn't that happen? And the answer is, have a look at it.
Some ideas work best in an ephemeral context.
Yes.
Where you do the imagining of them. And I think if you physically make them, then it becomes leaden.
That's crucial. That's absolutely crucial, I think.
It's like reading a book rather than seeing the film adaptation of that book. So it's exactly how I imagined it. And again, you're talking about how far an audience has to come to you with a big, whimsical, stupid idea. If the audience has made half the ideas up in their head, they're more with you than if you're just presenting it flatly to them.
Yeah.
And he goes further than that, doesn't he? He sort of gives you the impression that you are watching the ideas evolve in his mind as he is saying.
Live.
Yeah, yeah.
And he even does, there's a great bit in this show where he pretends that he's forgotten the rest of the show.
Couldn't check you. It's been a very wide reaction on that last-ish thing. We'll cut this. No, they're going to leave it in. You know, if you notice that, when people say, oh, we'll cut this, and it's always left in there. Anyway. Oh, I've forgotten the rest of the show. How's it going?
To be fair, sometimes you do. There's just a moment where in my jacket on every night I have part one and the running order for part one in the pocket, and at halftime I take it out and I put part two in. And I've done that for the last 6-9 years. Once this year, there was a bit. I was actually going into a Brexit bit. Because I hadn't done it in 6 weeks. But he's in the middle of a Western run, so clearly it's like prayers at school. You fall out of bed, you can kind of do whatever. But he still had that thing that, because he does no audience chat. He's not taking any ideas in. Which is all the point of audience. Everyone presumes audience chat is you. I'm going to pick on you, and it's not. It's just give me a random thing so I can be random for a while, and I can show that skill maybe. But like also I can put in things. I can invest a show with something which is definitely of this night and this night alone. Yeah. So that's the reason you go to the audience, which is I don't really care if you're an accountant or blah blah. I'm looking for some other detail that will inform the night and make it unique, right? But he doesn't do that. He does all the this is all just happening now kind of stuff without the obvious thing of going right, well, you said this earlier and now I'm going to try to weave that back in again. So it's interesting to watch, because obviously some of it is, he may just be constantly poking at it and changing it and adding little bits to it as it goes along. Like,
whatever. What do you think? What would your guess be?
I would imagine he's fecund enough that any time he does that, he may be other things are popping into his head, but he makes it obvious to you that this is a thing that's happening. But it's a conversational style anyway, so where that line is drawn, where it isn't.
True, you know,
and people
true.
Are dreadfully, amazingly, hilariously bad at spotting where it's a routine and where it's you talking. It's honestly the whole thing, this whole castle, this whole house of cards, this castle of sand is built on the fact that people often don't see the difference between you talking to somebody and you going into routine. Because sometimes you'll segue from an audio, oh, it's funny, and then you into a thing. And I've had people in reviews go, well, it seems to be all just talking to audience. And you're going, you know, that was like 10 minutes. And then everything after that was a show. That happens every night. Like, wow. But people are amazing. And look, it speaks to that kind of thing of, I want to think that this is just happening.
Yeah.
Even if this makes me unhappy, because I'd like to think you actually had a show, but you actually have to show people that there's definitely a show. The audience has to be between those who like the raw energy of this is just happening right now versus those who've paid money and got a babysitter and had an evening out, like whatever, and would like to think you've actually put something together.
How do you introduce an energy like that without going to the audience, which is what Eddie Izzard does?
I don't know how you do it. I need the prop of there's going to be a bit of the show which has to be different, and I have to be on my game when I write a bit into the show where I pointedly pull a stool out and plonk it in front of the audience and go, this is now going to happen here, and the conjuring act has to occur right now. And the only thing is actually sometimes I'm getting a little over some of it now personally, because there's a lot of IT and a lot of accountants and a lot of standard kind of
things. Is the collapse of the actual job sector
The manufacturing sector, the end of the manufacturing sector, people making things would have been wonderful.
Is anyone here from Trumpton? Does anyone have a job that has a uniform, a hat and a song?
Honestly, in terms of audience chat, it's jobs that appeared in a Richard Scarry book. That the audience all have, you're a fireman, you make candles, whatever. They all have a reaction to are the best things. And other than that, you're looking for some weird biographical detail. And it's kind of often tough to drag it out of people in a conversation like what it is. It's always worth going back for one more question. But see, this is again, he doesn't do that. He's not doing that at any stage. And he's never done that in any of his shows. But gives the impression of it being a rambling. It's in the air.
It's all in the noises.
But I think he is looking for stuff, but like, I don't think obviously it's not going to change that much. It's not like Ross Noble has an interesting thing as well, that people presume it's all off the cuff. And Ross obviously writes a show. Ross writes great comedy ideas and draws them out and does routines. But people presume it's all, he just makes it all up. Yeah, if you the stuff that you get away with during if it's clearly audience chat, the tension in the room is completely different to the rest of it. And so you get rewarded. The risk versus reward. The risk goes up and the reward goes up. You get a higher reward for actually slightly less funny things. Coming out of it. But honestly, a lot of it is the not dead behind the eyes. Like when you're touring and touring and touring and touring and touring, it's how do I keep this fresh? How do I keep my own energy levels up? And I think you have to be looking within the stuff for new things.
Is it routine then that actually you can become tired of doing the same show?
I think there's too direct an investment in their reaction. I always use the comparison of the mousetrap. As a thing, like whatever, that's not what I would want to be doing, like whatever, and I've never seen the mousetrap, I'm sure.
Eddie Izzard's first piece of material at the Live at the Ambassadors, because he's next to the mousetrap and he comes out and does a beautiful thing about...
So do beware. If you're in here for the mousetrap, it's the wrong place, right? The Mousetrap, an Agatha Christie whodunit thing that was in here, in this theatre, started off in this theatre, in 1483. And it ran here for 60 billion years. And it had to leave the theatre. You're probably wondering, well, you know, why did it leave the theatre? It left the theatre in the end because all the bricks in the theatre, all the foundations and the entire theatre turned to the show and said, fuck off! Just fuck off out of it! We know who did it!
Okay. And it's almost his opening gag is to say, almost a joke on saying, how would you keep doing the same thing every night? I hadn't even noticed that. His opening routine, his first big show, is about the grind of what it would be like to do the same show every night.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
I think there's times where I've looked out at the audience on a Tuesday night somewhere and just looked at them going, right, well, they have paid the same that the audience in the Edinburgh Play has paid, and they've made the same effort to be here, and just because it's Tuesday, and, you know, you have to remind yourself that they're... But the thing is, you're on a feedback loop, so it's...
Of course.
I mean, I'm like... I wouldn't say the phrase ambitious self-starter has to apply to us, because you have a strong... a motivational force of there being a crowd, and if they're not laughing, you very quickly go, geez, I better pick up my heels here, like whatever, and get them laughing. So I think it doesn't last long, any torpor, because you're out there, you know, and looking for the same response. And also, over the course of a week, the most striking thing, doesn't matter in terms of where you're going, is a big thing. Like, some towns are just big and raucous, some rooms are just better designed, but Monday night is quiet, Tuesday has more energy, Wednesday, it builds up to Saturday when it peaks in energy, and then Sunday drops precipitously. Doesn't matter where you're going on Sunday. The audience have bought the tickets, and I even say to them, like, whatever, you bought the tickets, you didn't know it was going to be a Sunday, you've all at some point at 6 o'clock gone, will we bother? Because you go, oh, I'm already into tomorrow, it's been the end of the weekend, no one is going, great, Sunday night, let's do something on Sunday night. Like,
do you get geographic differences in audiences as well?
Sheffield, famously, I found, because I hit a wall of talking to people in Sheffield. And I was going, has no one done this? Has no one? you know, this is what happens in this thing that I talk, and we have an interaction. They all just sat back, like, whatever. And at the end, big round of applause. They really loved it, like, whatever. And I went back the following year, and I teased them about this, and we all were having a laugh, but they were still only a little bit more vocal. And it's in Yorkshire, and Yorkshire's really interactive generally. But for some in Sheffield don't. There was a man there with a guide dog, and the guide dog, this happened a couple of times, people have brought in guide dogs to the show, and they always sit and see them at the front. And the guide dog stares at you in a doleful way, and it's the weirdest thing, because it's one dog just looking and going, this is what I'm at now. Okay, fine, I'll just sit quietly and look at you, with just his big brown eyes, is really sad looking at you, and it just saps all the fun. And I said to somebody out, going, oh, that's really weird. He said, they're always like this here. Bands do the thing where they go, now you sing in Sheffield, and all these Sheffield ones go, no, you sing. And fans go, okay, well, we'll sing it then. Yep, you sing it. Like, we've come to see you do the thing. I have a pet theory that places that are in a kind of ring around London, the Woking's, Dorking's, St. Albans, that kind of thing, the High Wycombe's, places where people move to at a certain age of their lives from out of London.
Yes.
And then Aylesbury, let's say, but they're not from there. And if you say, hey, who's here from Aylesbury? Or are you from Aylesbury? They go, no, well, you know, and because they've had some journey, you know, and they're actually from a small village just outside Aylesbury, like whatever, and they've no sense of real union with the place. Whereas you go to Glasgow, where you're from Glasgow, they even if you go to Manchester, Birmingham, whatever, they're from there.
Yeah.
And it's almost like the weird theory I have is that if a place is a football team, that they're used to shouting for their name. They're used to being a defining thing. And so they're a Dublin crowd. And so the best places are in the large urban centres. It's weird. And then there's comics who have their base, like Peter Kay Hughes across the north, and obviously it bleeds out to the rest of the country. Michael Hughes in the suburban south.
Yep.
Obviously bleeds across the country. I do particularly well in Dublin. That's my base gig. So we all have a kind of a place that we like radiate out from to a certain
Do you structure your tour so that you end up In the town.
Start in Dublin every year. There's a room called Vicar Street, which is a brilliant room, just a brilliant room for messing around in. So when the show is very new and you're just kind of, and every show is a very much a new, I'm adding, I'm changing. And also there's a touch of it's a memory test right at the very start. Yeah. I do the first 4 weeks in Dublin. But it means that the first few nights are people who really have gone to everything. They've gone, they followed the story and they're already in a kind of a, what's the next bit of this? And so you can pick up like it's a conversation. Like again, apologies to Crowbar, Eddie is out into a connecting about him. But like he does with the bad crumble and the thing that he'll know that people have been to a few of the shows, and you can never take that for granted. Unfortunately, stand up that it just always feels like everything is slightly new, and we're going to impress you all over again. And going from my crowd in Dublin to Hello Woking or Hello G Live in Guildford or something, where that's a brutal test of it in a certain sense. Of it's colder and people are sitting back in a there's a man off the telly here. The man of the is going to do some jokes. So, okay. And you're going, oh God, okay. So there's no support structure.
Is that what's so revolutionary and interesting, even as a non-stand-up, not understanding the technicality of this? Is that what's so interesting at watching Eddie Izzard? He's someone who's doing a thing which you won't notice when you're in the room on that night, because you only see him at one venue.
Yeah.
You've only seen him in this show, wherever it is. And what he's doing, the craft he's doing, which is stand-up, changes from night to night, and you never know how the audience is going to be, what the geography of the town is, whether it's a noisy crowd, a quiet crowd, what mood they're in. And he's going to do something up there that you could forgive him for being tense and for being on rails. And the real joy of watching Eddie Izzard is him getting up there and saying, ah, pausing calmly, you leaning in as a crowd, and he gives you what feels like the first thought that pops into his head. And oddly, that's so warm and welcoming.
Yeah.
It's the opposite of barking.
Yeah, yeah. It's opposite of coming out of like a club thing going, right, bang, I'm gonna show you.
Yeah.
I'm going to win this. It's like, no, I'm going to lean back. I'm going to lean back on my thing. And I'm going to start with the least built up ideas. The first two things, the thimble thing, the one after the thimble thing is again just a throwaway stuff. And then as the show goes on, you can see it becomes larger and larger routines. The Roman Latin thing, that's a good 20 minutes. The salmon thing at the very, very end, that's a perfect length for an encore piece. I mean, what they didn't show you is obviously clearly he's walked off stage and walked back on again, and this is the encore piece. But it starts off with him leaning back and going, you're in my world now. And in my world, it'll be a lot of the stuff that you know from your world, but I will also bring in things that you didn't expect. And yes, it'll start with the thing about
animals with haircuts.
But it'll always be rooted in this.
Yeah.
It won't ever untether itself and fly off too far. And then I will physically make the world appear, which is honestly one of the things that I think he just gets less credit for than he does. I will physically act this out. I will make this occur in front of you. And the finest review I ever had of him was just an incidental thing that somebody threw out once. I was talking to a boss of mine in Telly and RT who'd been to see, I think, the tour after this one. And he said, oh, and he's raving about it. And he said, and then he did a thing, and it seemed like a very small thing he said that he did. But by that stage, we were all in his thrall.
Yeah.
And A, what a great use of the phrase in your thrall. That's always been my landmark of it. But it was, we were just in his world. So therefore, all the steps he wanted us to take, we were willing to do because we were playing in his playground that he's created. And frankly, he could have done anything with us at that stage because we were in his thrall.
That is a brilliant description of what is effectively, and obviously for you, a masterclass in how to do this. What a brilliant thing to bring in. Thank you very much, Dara O'Brien.
Thanks.
Pleasure.